Award-winning British novelist Jim Crace says the job of fiction is to imagine the unimaginable. Take, for instance, the apocalypse. In his book, The Pest House, Crace envisions a post-apocalyptic America, a world laid low by eco-disaster and social collapse. He told Jim Fleming that our current conditions make it all too easy to imagine the worst sort of future.
At all times in history, we've had a sense that the world is unblemished and will remain unblemished forever, that it's untouchable, that it's here for eternity. But at the same time, we are fearful of the oddities in the way that people in the medieval times would be terrified by an eclipse of the sun, because we rely on things that we don't understand. And when something we don't understand, such as the sun, disappears for 24 hours or whatever it is, for an hour or so during a total eclipse, then that can be terrifying. We, of course, understand the nature of the universe much more, not entirely, but much more now. But there are still new things to frighten us. What is certain is that in the 21st century, we are besieged by different versions of how the world could end or change drastically and how that could happen soon. You know, we're told about things like nuclear meltdown. We're quite used to that over the last 70 years. But there are new things that we've added to that. Global warming. Finally, America and Europe, but America particularly, has recognized that global warming is galloping us towards problems. And there are other things such as contagions and pandemics. Now, I know that in the medieval times, people took those in their stride. They expected there to be black deaths and choleras. Modern medicine has rescued us from those things largely. But look at the way in which AIDS now affects 40% of the people in Botswana and Lesotho. And I heard a scientist saying that if avian flu is able to cross species and the number of deaths is equal to the number of deaths, you know, the same proportion as the number of the deaths that happened in 1919, the last time avian flu affected the United Kingdom, then 19 million people in the United Kingdom could die.
Let's talk about your story, then, this story, this future that you've created. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that this is America at some unspecified future date, clearly far enough in advance that the disaster occurred well before the beginning of the story. No one really remembers it, although close enough to that, I gather that the artifacts can still be found regularly of the time before the disaster, whatever it was.
Well, how long does it take anything to rot away? How long does it take a hulk of a ship to be reduced to something which looks almost natural? Probably 80 or 90 years. I mean, we know that polystyrene cups are going to still be there untouched in 1,000 years. But yes, you're quite right. I would say probably 100 years after now is what we're talking about.
And the people who have survived this now live with very little memory of that time. There seems to be almost no history for them.
Well, if you imagine a huge depopulation of America for one reason or another, we don't know what it's going to be, whether it's a pandemic or whatever it is. If you imagine a huge depopulation and a sudden one, even if that depopulation is worldwide, the effects on developed nations such as America and Britain is going to be greater than the effects on somewhere like the Sudan or a remote island in Indonesia. The reason is that our advanced civilizations are so separated from the natural world that we wouldn't know how to find and forage. We wouldn't know how to make rafts. Our ingenuity has failed to keep us informed about how to make fire or shelters, you know, with the help of a building company or safety matches. And so it would not be surprising if there was a collapse of population in the United States of America, given the size of the United States of America, if the infrastructure just collapsed. So that's the starting point. But what this book is not trying to do is to say this is a likely outcome for America. That's not the point about this book. This is not a book about America 200 years down the line or 100 years down the line saying this is a likely scenario. All this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for what I'm concerned about the American condition now. It's about our Western unconcern for the planet. It's about the dangers of being on the top of the pile and coping with being at the bottom of the pile. It's about the American dream and whether the American dream has become blemished in the same way as the American landscape has become blemished.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dream. I mean, I think we all know what the American dream is supposed to be now. You better yourself. In some ways, the dream of your characters is the same. And perhaps what you're saying is that their dream is not much different from ours. It's to attain something that they don't understand at all.
The American dream, it seems to me, is based on something very simple. And it's what accounts for the fact that that even though when they carried out an opinion poll in the Middle East just after the beginning of the Iraq War, they asked the question, which country in the world do you most despise? And 84%, I think, said America, predictably, you know, in the circumstances. But later down the opinion poll, they said, which country in the world would you most like to emigrate to? And 83%, you know, only lost 1% of those, said the United States of America. Now, this, in an odd way, it tells us about the whole ambiguity of the world's relationship with America. Why is it that America, even though the people who despise America politically, their foreign policy anyway, why is it that they still want to come here? It's because the American narrative is one of delivering on hopes, on coming up with the acre of land when you've never owned land, on giving the job when the dust bowls have robbed you of them, of giving you the Hollywood dream if you meet the West Coast. It's a dreaming narrative. American is based on a dreaming narrative, it seems to me. And that dreaming narrative is one which I, as an Englishman, have always bought into. Because the English narrative is entirely different. The English narrative is squeamish and stuttering and blushing. And it doesn't take any risks and it doesn't head out for the frontier. And even if it did head out for the frontier, there'd be no wilderness to encounter. So there's something very basic about the appeal of that press westward, the family with the kids on the mother's breast and the bucket and the cow tied to the back of the wagon, which in a way is beyond destruction. However, it feels that we've lost an image of that. We've lost that because when people now think about America, they don't think of those things. They think of something which is blemished. So my book is about investigating the blemish and revisiting the dream.
We should talk about where your book begins. It is in this future America, and the characters about whom we will care the most are Franklin and Margaret, going not west, as you suggest, but east, in the hope that they will reach the sea and be taken to some promised land. Maybe we ought to know a little bit more about Franklin and Margaret. And if you would, I wonder if you would read a little bit to describe Franklin for me.
In what remained of the slanting light, Franklin Lopez tried to sleep while facing east, downhill. The closeness of Ferrytown was a comfort to him. From his high vantage point, he had seen the busy little lanes and yards and watched the ferry, its raft boards packed with the day's last emigrants and their suddenly weightless possessions, as it was let out on its fat ropes to drift downstream, never quite capsizing, until the four helmsmen dug in their great oars and poles to bring the craft ashore in the shallows of the deeply gravelled landing beach. He had then watched the ferry, unladen, but now set against the river, being towed back upstream by a team of oxen on a winch, and beached for the night at the mooring. He had seen the first lamps lit and heard what sounded like a song. Surely Franklin could not wish for a prospect more reassuring or more promising than this. Once the moon came up, above the leaden volumes of clouds augmenting what was left of day, the lake in the valley, hidden up till then in mist, was like a silver pendant, with the river as its glinting chain. Franklin had not seen so much standing water before. Perhaps the sea would be like that, flat and safe and breathtaking.
It's disturbing, don't you think, that Franklin takes so much comfort in being close to Ferrytown, this place that we know by this time is going to be a place of death? Or is that just another part of this exploration you're making of the way in which our dreams aren't necessarily what we think they are?
Well, we take human comfort in things, but nature doesn't always play along. You know, it's a natural disaster that kills off the people in Ferrytown. In my books, there's always a tension that exists between the natural world and the so-called civilized world. And my books are always trying to mediate them. The natural world can be sour. The natural world can be full of putrefaction. The natural world can be unnecessarily shocking and cruel. So if we're going to get any mediation between those two things, we might as well admit the truth about it. In the same way that we, humankind, can be lacking in understanding of the natural world and inflict damage on the natural world in the careless way that we have, then the natural world can do the same back to us.
And this pest house, it's more attractive than it ought to be. In some ways, it turns out the pest house is the rock on which the rest of the story is built.
The pest house is America. The pest house is where you go to recover. There are such things. This book started, actually, with me discovering a real pest house on the Isles of Scilly, 35 miles off the coast of Cornwall, where I spend a lot of time, 140 islands there, of which only five are inhabited. And there's one uninhabited one, which in the 18th century was used as a quarantine station for people traveling to the United Kingdom. If you had so much as acne or rosacea or something, people would suspect it would be cholera, and they'd stick you in this pest house until you recovered. Of course, you wouldn't recover because there's already someone there that had got cholera, so you'd catch it and you'd die. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, what a fantastic title for a book. But I also realized that there was an important subject matter there, and the subject matter was emigration and our need to leave home to realize our hopes by going abroad to find those hopes. But hopes dashed, because here would be people traveling on a boat, and simply because they had a red cheek, even though they were within 35 miles and in sight of the cliffs of Cornwall, they would be stuck into the pest house and they would die. So that was the starting point of the book. At that point, when I encountered that story and that actual building, the subject matter of America was not one that I thought would fit into it. It was only when I became conflicted in my own attitudes towards America, you know, after 9/11 and after the Iraq War and after many, many visits here, that I realized that they were all of a piece.
And the pest house must hold some hope for you as well. In this story, it certainly does. Margaret survives the pest house, builds a future on having been yes. in the pest house.
The hope is this, that optimism and hope are found in dark places. An optimism which is found, you know, in a well-lit Hollywood studio is not an optimism worth having. An optimism which is found in a religion which tells you that when you die, you know, you're merely going to spend eternity with heaven. It's such an infantile optimism that it's worthless. I'm an immensely optimistic person. And the optimism that I find in my books, although most people don't recognize it as optimism, is optimism which is as hard as granite because it's come from a tough place. So what I'm saying, I think, in this book is that we all have to go through the pest house, or what that represents, the metaphor of the pest house. America as a nation has to go through the pest house. Britain has and will continue to have to go through pest houses in order to experience the furnace that life provides and in order to come out stronger.
Jim Crace is an award-winning writer, author of Being Dead, Quarantine, and most recently, The Pest House. He spoke with Jim Fleming.